You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Everybody, welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and that other gentleman with darker hair, probably more of it than me on the screen, is somebody people may know about. He's got quite a following in certain circles. His name is Graham Stephan. Graham Stephan. He is an entrepreneur. He made his first leap into success through real estate, but at some point in his career, we will talk about that. He veered into the YouTube world, into the world of podcasting, and which is not where I know him from, and is quite successful there as well. And we'll talk about that, I hope. So Graham, thank you so much for doing this and being willing to, and welcome.
Absolutely. Yeah. As soon as you sent me a message on Facebook, I'm like, oh man, that's so cool. Blast from the past. I'm all for it.
Yeah. So that's the truth. Truth in advertising. The blast from the past is Graham went to high school at a school that I co-founded and ran for almost 20 years. And we know each other from that, although We probably spoke more after you graduated from high school at a college reunion than we did when you were in high school.
I think so. Yeah, probably.
You were a very quiet young man.
Yeah, I came in and, like, listen, I really enjoyed New Roads, and I felt comfortable with all the students. Everyone was very compassionate. Everyone is incredibly nice. I just had a problem with school. And that my only problem was I had an interest in just working and making money. And so anything that didn't directly correlate to me, like bringing my laptop into class and trading penny stocks or trying to like read some business book, I had a really difficult time concentrating and focusing and putting my time and attention on it. But one of the things with New Roads that I really enjoyed, it was a geometry class. I think it was 10th grade. And
Robert Kuhar,
maybe he had like short dark hair. Yeah. And I remember him doing like a final exam or something at the end of the year, and he said the final exam could be anything, but it has to relate to geometry in some form or fashion. And I was talking to him and I said jokingly, can I do a final on why I'm never going to use geometry in my life? And he said, yes, as long as you could make your argument and articulate it, I will grade it the same way that I could grade everyone else's. And my gosh, I mean, I wish more teachers would do that, because that really got me in the mindset of, okay, well, how could I articulate this point? How could I argue effectively? And it really forced you to go and think through every narrative you have. And I actually spent a lot of time on that, because I wanted to like prove myself that like, hey, this is, I'm right.
Did you find yourself learning a little bit more geometry by making that argument?
No. But it taught me everything else of just thinking through your beliefs, what serves you, what doesn't, writing it out. I just think effective communication like that is so important. And any other teacher would say, no, it has to be on like how you're going to use geometry, but the kids are going to begrudgingly just like force themselves through this. Right. But to really think outside of the box, that's what New Roads was great at, was just like, you know, not going in one direction and really thinking independently from one another. And that was awesome.
And do you think that you came in with that characteristic, or did you leave with that with that trait? Did it open you to doing that?
Yeah, I came in with it for sure, but New Roads cultivated it. I think New Roads is really great at taking whatever your strengths are and leaning into that. Like, I feel like a lot of schools, they go by the weakness of like, hey, this kid can't run, so we're going to put him in track and field.
We're going to make sure he runs, right?
But like, hey, the kid who's really good at reading, let's lift that up. And I think everyone is born with just a natural talent and a thing that they're just good at. And I think it's really important to find whatever that is and hone that and build that up.
Well, so for the people who have never heard of Graham Stephan, and I remember thinking about your choice and your decision in a way I suspect would surprise you. Graham chose, unlike perhaps anyone else in his graduating class, Graham chose not to go to college, but instead to dive into the work world, which he actually was in the middle of while he was in high school. But and I always thought of you as like a quiet, old human being, because that was so against the flow. Everybody else is going that way. I'm going to stick my hand out and it's going to take me out of focus. Everybody was going in that direction, and Graham made the choice to go some other direction. And that takes some nerve. I'm curious about where that came from. Like, so you grew up in a family in Santa Monica. What was it like? What were your folks like? You know, and did you always have an issue with school, or did that come somewhere along the way?
I mean, my parents grew up like very, I don't know, lower middle class, not to the point where we like couldn't pay rent throughout the year, but it was definitely more like, hey, finances are pretty tight. But they really did their best to shield me from any financial issues that was going on. So like as a kid, I really wouldn't know. But I've always been like just naturally a saver. So when I would get, because I remember my grandma would give me like $50 for my birthday. And that was a big, but I'd keep the $50. I wouldn't spend it. And I would remember like, I get this $50 here. And, you know, for Christmas, I get this 20 from them. And that's like, and then I save it up. And then I'm like, wow, I have $100. I wouldn't spend it. So I've always been like that. But in terms of just, I don't know, being defiant against like whatever structure, I would say, yeah, to a certain degree, I just always knew what interested me and what I wanted to do. And if someone tried dragging me away from that, I wouldn't react well. Like, I'll give you an example. My dad wanted me to go to karate classes, and I hated going to karate. I hated it. And I would throw tantrums and throw fits. I did not want to go to karate. And so he found a way to get me to go to karate by bribing me with a pack of Pokemon cards. And so if I went to karate, I got to open up that pack of Pokemon. And in the Pokemon cards could be a Charizard. So I found a way to like, okay, if I'm going to do this, at least I get something back in return. So I think that kind of sets something in motion where like, hey, if there's something I want, I'm going to find a way to get it.
And what did your folks do? Like, what was the work that, you know, your dad or your mom, whoever worked, or both of them, what did they do?
Yeah, so my dad is an animator. And he did a lot of storyboard for Disney throughout the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
And then he did storyboard for live action when Disney kind of shut down their animation department. So that was my dad, very artistic. Right. And my mom's a therapist. And she would work from home and typically take on clients either through the phone or they would come in. She had like a little bedroom turned office in the front.
Right. So right.
That was them.
And okay, so then they put you in an unusual, a progressive, let's call it that, high school, which charged tuition. So they could have sent you to public school, but they cared about your education, I'm assuming, in some way.
Well, yes and no. New Roads was my choice. So I've been in public school my entire life.
Yeah.
And initially, I went to a school called Smash in Santa Monica. Sure. Yeah. And I loved it. I loved the small class sizes. We were like core 1, 2, and 3. So they cram like 3 grades together in like one class. I really loved it. But there wasn't any like, my parents were worried that I wasn't going to learn like math and like learn stuff that, you know, should be taught. And that by the time I get into high school, I'd be way behind.
Right.
So they moved me from that to John Adams Middle School.
I was going to say, you probably went to John Adams.
Yeah.
Right?
And that was okay.
Yeah.
But then I went from John Adams to Santa Monica High School for ninth grade. I hated it. Absolutely hated it. I remember like fights breaking out and like lunchtime, like all these just I had zero interest in this whatsoever. And a friend had mentioned something about like New Road School, or like telling about it. I was like, I want to go there. And listen, and at the time, like I have no perception of like tuition or anything, nothing. So we applied and I got admitted on, I'm not sure what percentage financial aid or scholarship it was, but it was what my parents could afford to pay. I remember the day I found out that I got into New Roads was the day that Santa Monica High School was on lockdown.
A
riot that broke out. And so my mom picked me up from school and she had a letter in her hand and she opened the letter so she knew I was in it. She told me I got in. I thought that like, that is a divine intervention. Like the day the school gets locked down is the day that I find out, you know, I won't be going back. So.
Good. That's good.
Great.
Yeah.
But that was my doing. My parents would have preferred probably that I stayed at Santa Monica High School, but that was all me. I wanted to go to New Roads.
And when you told them, at some point you told them, I'm not going to college. Was it good for you, you know, chase your dreams, or was it, wait, what?
Okay. Initially I didn't want to go. But they wanted me to apply to schools and I thought, okay, so I'm going to apply to some schools and let's see what happens. And I wanted to go to Pepperdine. And the only reason I wanted to go to Pepperdine was because it was a great area. That was it. That's all I really knew, is just like, it's a beautiful campus and it's close. Right. That's right. It. And I had no idea how I was going to get in. I had no idea who would pay for it. I had no plan, but I did apply. And instantly denied. I mean, I didn't have good grades. I didn't have good test scores. Like everything was bad. And I thought that I would win them over with like a great essay of like why they should pick me. Cause I was into reef aquariums and like, you know, trading stocks and all this. So I didn't get in. And so that was the point where I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to, that's a sign and I'm going to do something else instead. And I thought, What sort of lifestyle do I want? I don't want to have a boss. I want to do my own thing. I want to work for myself. I want to do something that is different every day, where I'm not going to be like in an office. And that was real estate. And so I figured, I'm just going to try to get my real estate license and see what happens. And when I started getting my real estate license, I'd go to open houses and just talk to agents, and I forget how I'd find these things. Maybe they were in the newspaper at the time.
Yeah.
And I would just look at the open houses that were over $5 million. And just because I was like, if I'm going to sell real estate, I'm just going to go to the very top. And so I just showed up at those open houses and introduced myself. I talked to the agents and just asked them for advice. I just asked them, how do you get clients? How did you start? What's your advice for me? I want to do this. Where should I begin? And I just kept doing that until I met an agent who really was just so kind and took me under his wing and said, you know, if you're looking to start, you know, just come show up at my office and I'll put you to work. That's what I did. And so for the first little bit, I was basically just doing whatever he wanted. If it was like, hey, my car is parked on level P5. Could you go and like grab my wallet so I could get my checkbook? Like I would do that, or putting up open house signs. Or he would say like, I'm showing a house at this time. Can you get there 30 minutes before and turn on all the lights, open the door, make it look fine? I did everything. That really taught me a lot. And then he would split whatever business I brought in. We just split it 50-50 because I didn't know what I was doing. So I would be sitting open houses. He would have open house books from months ago where someone put their name, and I would just call just the whole list. Anytime someone emailed on something, I was just like responding to it, just trying to pick up the scraps. Like he was already busy. So yeah. Like anyone that was falling through the cracks, I would work those people.
And it's so. Okay. But you found early success at this, or no?
Yeah. Yes. It was pretty quick. It was, keep in mind, I was 18. And so like, when I would make a $500 commission, it wasn't worth anybody's time. But for me to make $500 for like 2 weeks of work, I couldn't be happier. Like that was $500. And so what I would do is do the deals that no one else wanted to do because it wasn't worth their time. And these are like little lease deals. These are clients who are just time wasters, driving to like a different part of town in rush hour traffic for like an $800 commission that you would spend weeks working on. I would do it all. I would do everything I could. But for me, at the time, like that was pretty significant.
And were you still living at home?
Yeah. Yeah. So my expenses at that time, yeah, I was living with my dad and my expenses were zero. So I was just, you know, what would I spend money on? Gas, phone bill, car insurance, some food. I mean, it was just, but my default was just like, I'm going to save everything.
Got it. Got it. So yes, it's that the $50 from grandma, now it's $500 from that sale. And it all get as much of it as it could get banked.
Yeah.
And when did you switch from trying to sell houses to investing in houses?
2010, 2011. So I was saving all of my commission, everything. And I was terrified of spending money because in real estate, you're only paid when you close the deal.
Sure.
And it got to a point where I saw these guys that were making like $500,000 a year, but they were so stressed out about money. And I couldn't understand it because they make $500,000 a year, but they're needing this commission to come in to pay their bills. And I saw also the volatility because that was really the time where a lot of agents were losing their jobs. So basically, I started in 2008, like right as the market had peaked and was coming down. And so I saw in end of 2008, agents were leaving. I saw in 2009 that agents were getting part-time jobs. Like they would work as an agent during the day and then have a restaurant job like Spago, which was next door at the time. They would work there at night just to be able to supplement bills. So like I saw quite a lot of people getting out of the market, not closing deals. And I just thought, you never know when your last deal is going to be. And I didn't like having to rely on that. And so in 2010, I started working with this investor. He, again, he was a guy that no one wanted to work with because he was buying short sales and foreclosures around Long Beach and Compton. And these agents didn't want to drive from West LA down to those areas and deal with properties that are short sales that usually take anywhere from 6 to 18 months to close that were selling for like $100,000+. But for me, I would do it. So I'd be driving down there, showing him places. And I would ask him, what do you look for in this? What's your plan with this? And I remember specifically, he's like, okay, well, I'm going to take down this wall and there's some extra space here so we can make this into another bedroom. And we're going to throw some paint up here and finish these floors and do this kitchen. And then afterwards, you know, I'm going to be able to rent it out for this. And the value is going to be this. And then I remember asking him like, hey, when your contractor's here, could I just stop by and watch? It's like, yeah, sure. So I would drive down to Compton and watch them remodel this house and learn from what they're doing. And then he started going on from that area to San Bernardino. And he would send me his criteria. And I thought, wait a second, like this is, if this guy is doing it and he's like a lawyer, he lives in Beverly Hills and he's putting his money here. Like everything he was just putting in this, I thought this is a really good opportunity. I should be doing this too. And so, you know, his price point was higher than mine. So I thought, well, I'm not competing with him either. So, you know, if his price point's $200,000+, I could buy something sub $120,000. And that's what I did. And so because I was an agent, I had MLS access. I could see everything as soon as it came up. And I would go on weekends with a friend. And we would go to every single house that we could find in this price point just to see what it was like. We'd see like 15 homes on a Saturday, hang out. It was fun. And so what I would do is when a home would come on the market, I knew the market so well that I would just write an offer where if it gets accepted, I'm taking it. And because a lot of these were short sales, the way it would work is that you submit the offer.
Tell people what a short sale is in case they don't know the real estate world.
Yeah. So a short sale is when someone's underwater on their mortgage. So in this case, the houses used to be worth $400,000. And so what they would do is they take out a loan of $400,000 against the house. But the loan often had a balloon payment on it, or it was like a short-term payment. And then all of a sudden they ballooned to something major. Well, what happened is a lot of people had these balloon payments that would get to a point where they just couldn't afford anymore. The market crashed. And so now you have you owe $400,000 on a home that's only worth $100,000. And so what people would do is that they would just say, I can't make the payments. Even if I could make the payments, I'm not going to make them because I'm going to be under, there's no point. And what they allowed you to do is basically just give the property back to the bank, walk away from it.
Right.
Now it's the bank's problem.
And they don't want a house. Right.
And that was a big bailout that was put together to basically save the banks because so many people were just walking away from their homes because they couldn't afford it and it didn't make sense to pay. And so the banks would be kept with all these properties. So what they would do is do a short sale, which is where the seller accepts an offer, submits it to the bank, and then the bank has anywhere from 3 to really 24 months to decide if they want to eat the loss on the property. And if they eat the loss, the seller could just walk away. And that was the benefit to the seller. And so what I would do, because I would basically write these offers, and I had like 15 to 20 offers at any given point that were submitted on properties. But then what would happen is that you didn't hear back for like a year. So in 2010, I just started writing these offers all the time. Anything that would come up, I knew exactly what it was worth. And I just write that offer. And you would just wait. And I waited about a year. And then slowly but surely, you'd hear back from the banks. And the banks would say, we're not going to take this offer, but we could take this. And you're first in line. And so then at that time, I'd say, all right, is that worth it? Yes or no? And so the first place I bought, I waited maybe about 12 months.
And did you have the funds to pay this? Or did you get it? You got a loan?
Yeah, I had a loan. No loan. I paid cash because I had been saving at the time for 4 years, like all of my commissions. But these were not expensive houses either. The first house I bought was $59,500 was the first house I bought. And I put $12,000 into it, fixing it up with the same contractor that was doing these Compton houses. And I rented it out. The first tenant, also a big mistake, but I think I rented for like $1,150 a month, maybe $1,200 a month. But that got me thinking now that, wait a second, now I don't have to rely on a commission. And if I could just make like $2,000 a month, I could pay for all of my expenses. And then everything else is gravy on top. So then I bought another house. It was $72,000. I spent $8,000 fixing that up. And then a triplex that was $125,000.
And okay, so this is growing into a thriving business, or
not really? I would say that it gave me financial stability, where I knew every month I could make, I think it was about $3,000 a month, give or take, that I felt pretty confident in, and I knew that if I never close another deal in my entire life, I knew that I could skirt by and have a roof over my head, food, bills paid with $3,000 a month. That's it. And so that gave me a lot of just reassurance that like, hey, you know, everything's going to be okay. I don't need to close a sale, but when I do, I'm going to save it. And
so all this time when you're investing, you're also working as a real estate agent trying to sell houses.
Anytime I'd get a commission, I just plop it savings. And so I viewed the two as separate. Like rental income pays for expenses. Commissions get saved to then buy more rentals and then over time my lifestyle would be able to increase. I'd be able to do nicer things. But I would never exceed that.
And so when did the needle go into the exhale, things are okay, I'm succeeding? When did it flip into the other zone?
It never has. Now always I feel like I'm behind. I know it's ridiculous. It's a mental thing, but always I would say I'm worried. But I always, in the back of my mind, I think, okay, well, listen, the market could fall 50%. This could go to zero. That could go to zero. You get hit with a health scare. Like, I always think of every little thing that could come and poke a hole.
What could go wrong? Right.
Yeah. That's the way my mind works. It's always scanning. Where is something going to go wrong?
But then, I mean, I don't think that's a bad characteristic. Maybe I don't think it's a bad characteristic because you're talking about me as well. Right. But at some point, you stopped doing, well, are you still selling houses, but are you stopped doing that and started doing YouTube? Or maybe you started doing YouTube and or started doing,
I was doing what, both.
Whatever, content. And
yeah, so YouTube was an inspiration in 2011 or 2012. There's this YouTuber, his name is Rob Dom. He had a yellow Lamborghini Diablo, and he posted a video on YouTube of what he did for a living to afford a Lamborghini. And at the time on YouTube, this was unheard of. No one had ever done this before. Here's a guy, though, breaking down, like, I did this. I graduated from college. I started this company. And here's what, how I saved. And here's how much it is. And here's where I live. Like, he broke down everything. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this is so inspirational and so helpful for me that, like, more people should be doing this. And I wanted to do it. But I thought that no one would listen to me. Because at the time on YouTube, to get views, you had to have a Lamborghini. It sounds so stupid, but like, really, but like, unless you had a Lambo behind you, no one would listen to you. And this was like 2011. So I just was like, okay, I don't have a Lambo, but one day. And so I just postponed it. And then 2016 came around. I was 26. And I thought, you know what? If I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. And I'm going to look back at 10 years later and regret not taking the chance, because I was really nervous about putting myself online. And I thought, like, what if someone I know sees my video and they think it's bad, or I embarrass myself, it's dumb. So I just did it. And I posted a YouTube video at an open house about just my entire story, kind of what we were talking about, how I got started in real estate, my background, how I was saving, and my whole philosophies when it came to, like, you know, investing and all that. And I posted it and nothing bad happened. And I got like a nice comment. And I was like, oh, wow, okay, this is cool. I'm going to do another one. So I posted another one. And I was like, okay, cool. Still, it's okay. I'm going to do another one. And then I think like the third or fourth video, I started getting really into SEO at the time, because I realized on YouTube, the search was like Google. And that if you're on the first page of how to buy real estate or real estate investing for beginners, you could get, you know, a decent amount of traction. So I started angling my videos towards showing up in search results.
Right.
So my thing was like, I wanted to be number one in real estate, passive income, real estate investing, like all of these topics. And so I was able to just like figure out on Reddit forums, like how to title videos, how to thumbnail videos. And because I watched a lot of YouTube, I had an eye for what would do well. And then I want to say maybe about a month in, I started to make some money from it. And it was like,
make some money with how?
You make money with ads.
With ads.
So the ads run, yeah, you get AdSense. Yeah. Right. And so I started making like $1 a day. And I thought, wow, over a month, that's a free all you could eat sushi for free, just by doing what I would have done anyway. And that turned into like, you know, there was days where I was making like $20 in a day. And I thought, whoa, like, you know, I could pay all my groceries in like a few days of doing this for free. Like everything was just like now free.
Doing this thing that you enjoyed doing anyway.
I would do it anyway. So yeah. Like I was working as a real estate agent. I would finish usually around like 7 or 8. And then I would work from like 8 to 2 o'clock in the morning doing YouTube videos every single night. But I loved it. Like I would wake up in the morning and be like, all right, only 5 more hours until I could post on YouTube and make a YouTube video. And but that started to snowball. And then pretty quickly, one of my videos just got like a major push out of nowhere. And it was getting recommended against another video that had a lot of views. And I was the next up video. So everyone that watched one video, it automatically went to mine. And that day I made like $180 in a day. And that was the point for me where I realized like, this is something that's going to be significant. I got to take this seriously. And so I kept posting and it kept increasing.
But what was different? What did take it seriously look like that you weren't doing before?
3 videos a week I found was a sweet spot, no matter what, at the same time, no matter what. And I would also respond to every single comment.
Wow.
Every single one. I would stay up. I would not go to bed until every single comment had been answered. And even before I would go to bed, I would refresh. And if I got a new comment, I would respond to that one. And so I did. I just kept doing that. But I was really afraid of ever quitting real estate, because YouTube is so fickle. It's like things I've seen, a lot of the creators that I used to watch would just disappear.
They're gone.
Yeah. Or the algorithm, which like prank channels were big when I was first starting. And there were some algorithm changes there where overnight they all got demonetized and they all got deprioritized on the rankings for algorithms. So I just thought, yeah, it's just a matter of time until, you know, it could happen to any channel. So I just kept doing that in conjunction with real estate. And then I didn't go full time into YouTube until 2020 when everything shut down. And that's right. When I went full time on YouTube.
So what does full time on YouTube look like now? Because the name of the podcast is the...
It's called the Iced Coffee Hour.
It's still called the Iced Coffee Hour. Yeah. Yeah. Wait, so the person that was living in the back house, that's the partner that you have you doing it or no?
He's my co-host on the podcast he started off doing assistant work, and then he went from assistant to editor, and then he went from editor to editor and podcast co-host, and then he was so good at podcasting that he outsourced his editing and now is a podcast host. He moved up the ranks.
Yeah. And so if somebody were to say, the podcast you do, what's his name?
Jack Selby.
Right. So with the podcast you do with Jack is still the Iced Coffee Hour.
Yes. And
is it still financial information or you've expanded? You just said before we went on a couple of months ago, you had Charlie Kirk on.
Yeah.
And that wasn't for financial information, was it? Was it?
I would say because my interest is finance. So the podcast started talking about finances. Then we realized that finance only goes so far. You could only say so much on finance before it becomes repetitive. Then we started having on entrepreneurs or business owners. Then there's only so many times you could tell a startup story.
Right.
So we really try to evolve with someone who either has a unique opinion, unique insights onto something, a unique story, something that they have to bring to the table. And so we would also have on different political sides.
Sure.
And we would try to balance it. So if we had someone on the right, we try to immediately afterwards post someone on the left, right, like as far opposite as we could get. Even with finance, we have this guy, his name is Ben Mala, and he's big into debt. Like he borrows as much money as possible from the bank. So we'd post him. And then right afterwards, we'd post Dave Ramsey, who is so anti-debt and he never borrows money. And he got no credit cards, no nothing. So I like, you know, if we post Ben Shapiro, immediately afterwards, we could have Anna Kasparian and just get both, you know? So that was always for us. But we like to throw, because my interest, I'm not big into politics. I care about finances and the market. And so with anyone we have on, even with Ben, I was more curious about like, where do you invest?
Right.
How did you grow your business? How many people run it? How does the back end work with budgeting? And with Charlie, we talked about just the back end finances, and then it evolved into who should pay on the first date. Should it be the guy or the girl? And so like, I enjoy the money. Like, I just care about like, where do you invest? How does this work? Like that's, but Jack is interested in new things and exploring ideas. So I'm
so less works.
Big into that. Yeah. So, yeah. So I approach it from the money angle, and Jack is very inquisitive of just why do you believe what you believe?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Mm-hmm. No matter what it is, it's just want to get down to the nuts and bolts of it. Why is this?
That's it. Yeah. And it were as good. Well, yeah. So let me ask you a question. Going back to that initial decision that we were speaking about, you know, to pursue the thing you were interested in and forego the college route, which is where most people, well, at least most people from a certain strata go. Do you ever regret it? But also, do you ever think about what else do you want to learn? Are you learning new things about the thing that you're interested in, finance? Are you learning new things by doing the podcast? Or are you longing for some other enrichment, some other source of whatever it's called, ideas, insight?
No. So no regret for not going to college, zero. I constantly think about it today, how glad I am I didn't go. So I have the opposite of regret. I'm just constant gratitude.
Right.
But as far as no, the podcast is what I enjoy the most. Like by far, hands down, I love it. my main channel where I'm going through, and it's just me, it's just a talking head of like, here's what's going on today in the news. That's a bit more repetitive, but people enjoy it, and I have it down to a science. I know exactly the format, how to get out a video. That's a bit more autopilot. I would, you know, sometimes I really enjoy it, but then sometimes I see that as just like, oh, I gotta get out a video. But listen, again, that's I think if 80% of the time I enjoy it and 20% I don't, that's pretty good. That's a good ratio overall. But the podcast is like 99% I enjoy it.
Can you identify a moment? This is generally, I'm not asking you to pick one, but can you identify moments in your life that were pivotal? Like something happened, you did something, somebody else did something, you saw something that sort of reoriented how you think about things. Are there moments that you look back on that really reoriented who you were as a person, how you thought about things?
Yeah, I have been in a perpetual state of always say yes to everything, because I've always felt that like you never know when the window is going to close. And I've just, and the reason I say this is because I've seen so many people take for granted this internet success, or like they had some unique opportunity and they blew it because they either passed it up or they thought it was just going to last forever and they just took it for granted. And so I've done my best when someone presents me with like, hey, you could do this, or you could speak at this place, or hey, you could flip this and you could do it. Like, I was like, yes. I'd say yes to everything. And it got to a point, maybe it was about a year ago, where I started being like really unhappy just because I had all these obligations that I just didn't want to go to. And it felt like I started to be like that kid going to karate class again. Like, I don't want to go to karate class, but I said I was going to be there. And now I'm not the one to not keep my word on something, so I'm going to do it. And so I started going through these things, but just really, I wasn't enjoying it. I wasn't having fun with it anymore. And I thought, how nice would it be just to simplify things? And that was the point where I really started cutting a lot. I started saying no to a lot of things. I started, people would present me with like, hey, you could speak here. And I'm just, no, I'm not going to do it. And I'm still learning. And even now I'm in the process of just simplifying things. I want as little on my plate every day as possible. And that's the opposite of what I used to be doing. Just because now for the first time is I valued peace of mind. And even now, like on my phone, I have like some text that is a reminder every day to run every decision I say by this. And if it doesn't fit, I just say no. And I'll read a few. Well, I'll just read this.
Yeah, read it.
So for any decision I make, I have to think to myself, is it 80-20 results? So is it like that 20% that's going to give me an 80% return? Or is it something that is just, it's that little bit, like, but it's going to be 80% complexity? Then say no. The next question, though, is does it add complexity to my life? Does it add time? Does it add complexity? Yeah, anyway. Does it add hassle? And then if the answer is yes to those, I just say no.
You don't do it.
Automatically. I also really don't like spending money. And that is one thing that I've had a mental block on my entire life. I can't spend money on something unless I know it's either going to hold its value or give me a positive ROI. And so that usually means that I just won't spend. And so like, as an example, let's just say I could valet park for $10, or I could park like a half a mile away for free. I park a half a mile away for free. Or if there's something on a food menu, the item I really want is 30, but there's an item that might taste pretty good for 20, I get the 20. So like every single little thing is like, I go through I basically just prioritize that. So I'm spending money now if it makes my life easier, if it adds convenience, and it brings peace of mind without thinking of it. Because I've also had expenses come up that it ruins my week.
Unanticipated surprise expenses.
Like, I'll give you an example. There was a sewer line repair that I had to do on a property, and they quoted me $20,000. And even now, it bothers me. But I would ruminate for weeks on this expense. I would just spend so much of my time trying to bring it down to a price that I thought was fair. But I would spend more time on that than I could have spent just doing anything else with a higher ROI.
Mm.
So anyway, I'm trying now to have a bit more balance and not have such a scarcity mindset when it comes to like keeping what I have and not, you know, well, spending more than I need to.
And in light of what you just said about adding complexity and adding time and et cetera, I'm all the more pleased that you said yes to doing this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
When there was no big return for you.
This doesn't add complexity. I'll tell you, it would add complexity if you said, hey, you need to fly to this location on this date. Then it's complexity. This for me is easy. This is zero complexity. Yeah.
It sounds like you've made a decision about trying to live your life in a certain way that is not easy or comfortable for you in some ways, right? So you love doing you love doing YouTube.
Yeah.
But you are now you focused on you will spend money if, or you will say no if, et cetera, et cetera. And that doesn't, it feels a little bit like you're putting on clothes that you're not sure fit.
Yeah. It's getting to a point where it's too hyper-focused. Like I will, what was it? Man, there was a recent one that was really funny. And it was like, I was calculating the cost per minute of splitting a hotel room with Jack versus each of us getting our own room. And then I was doing that calculation and then calculating what it would be after tax per minute of sleep of, yeah, like stuff like this. Like I'm talking these calculations. And Jack said he thought it was so stupid. But then I thought, well, I'm doing this sitting at a red light. What else am I going to be doing with that time? So it's free money. And then he says, well, imagine if your mind is opened up to think of anything else, what other opportunities would present themselves and your mind isn't focused on, okay, the room is, you know, going to be 50 cents a minute or like, I don't know what it was, but like.
But that's the puzzle, right? Is there anything else do you have any clues about anything else that you would want to be thinking about? Like Jack is standing in the position of, well, there are all these interesting things to think about, or maybe not, or maybe you'll discover them if your mind is not being busied by calculating. And that's, sure. But so that's how his mind works. And I guess I'm asking if you've got any clues about what those things would be.
I have no idea. Because the thing is, it's all I know. It's all I know is how to do these little mental calculations and figure out how much something is going to cost after tax, put a value to it, and then decide is that the best use of capital. That's all I've thought about for 20 plus years. So it's hard to turn that off.
Isn't that part I get.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it's more than an academic exercise, right? You're not doing it simply as an academic exercise. You're doing it to decide whether or not to get one room or two rooms.
Correct.
And at least, you know, like I never count anybody else's money, but you're not at a position where counting dollars.
No.
Is going to, right? Getting the hotel room or not. Getting your own hotel rooms or not is not going to affect your life in any other way, right?
No, but here's how I think of it. It's like, imagine the savings is $30. I think, well, then that means I could go and get a free all-you-could-eat sushi for $30. And then
you could get all-you-can-eat sushi for $60 and not have it impact other than you're ruminating about it. It wouldn't impact how you live your life.
No. Right? But yeah, and I know you're correct. Like I know when people tell me this intuitively, like I know they're correct.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult habit to break. And I feel like sometimes I am wasting money and devaluing it without going through the calculus. Like I feel like
not according to
that's why I'm trying to break it. Because just because I've had these series of expenses come up and things that is just like, I'm spending so much time thinking through every, like, I'm calculating whether or not it's worth it to sell a rental property because I could make 5.8% after taxes, but then I write in depreciation recapture on that when I were to sell it and commissions versus making like, you know, 4.9% tax free in a muni bond. And then I break down my time spent in each of those and then how much that's going to be per hour. And then I extrapolate. It sounds funny, but I have whole ChatGPT conversations with this where like the after tax value of per hour of time built in with appreciation, appreciation over time in West Los Angeles versus depreciation recapture versus just all of this.
And where did you?
Hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
And by the way, and the difference is probably instead of making 5.8 is like 4.9. Like that's what it is.
Where did the list that you, those two lists that you just read before?
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
That came from an obligation I took on because I decided it was a good cash on cash return. And I calculated that I could get, it was a fantastic and it was really good on paper. But then I didn't account for the amount of time I would be on the phone, the amount of hiccups along the way, the little fires you'd have to put out, stressing on deadlines. And so the amount of time that I put into that for the really good return is probably negative when I could have just done anything else. But I said yes because I looked and I was like, wow, this is a great investment.
Wait, which is a great investment? That list that you came up with?
No, this is before the this before the list is now after going through everything that I have and just I've had so much on my plate now and every one of these things could have been prevented had I had the list.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So did you come up with that list? Did ChatGPT come up with that?
I did. I was just trying to simplify in my own words. And I go through it every now and then.
So you spent whatever X amount of time coming up with that list.
Yeah.
And did you think it was a good investment? You're not sure yet. That amount of time, you could have been spending that amount of time on other things.
Correct. Yeah. No, it was awful. It was awful only for the amount of like as a return on investment on a cash on cash return is fantastic for the amount of time, hassle, complexity. And it's very much a 20, like an 80-20 or 20-80, you know, it's 80% of work for the 20%.
But with the 20% of what of money. But what about joy units?
Yeah, exactly. None whatsoever. So I got so that's why I did the list.
But the consequence, I think this is true. I mean, it seems to make sense to you that the result that will come out of trying to follow that list will give you far more joy units than I get that they're incommensurate. But then the joy units that you would get, then the amount of money you've lost by wasting that time because it didn't result in cash, right?
Yep.
100%. Yeah.
So
right. I think you're right. I mean, I think, well, you know, maybe this is just because my hair is white. Joy units matter. And at some point, they matter more.
Yes. Yeah. I'm learning. I'm learning.
Not to the point of getting rid of that you know your life better than me, that chunk of money that needs to be set aside because you're going to have to do the sewer repair. You're going to have that, you know, you're going to have an expense that was unanticipated. What do you mean leaking the roof? Like, right? You know, that those are going to be there. So that you have, but it sounds like that exists, that chunk. Even though it's always a calculation, because you'll never know how much it could be. It can always possibly be more than you've accounted for.
Very true.
Right. And that's the worry. I get it. I totally get it.
Yeah. But, so I'm trying this out. I'm going to see how it plays.
How long has this been?
Only a few weeks. This is brand new.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
So far, so good. But yeah, it's been relatively recent.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think I'm curious about this experiment. So
me too.
So good.
I'll report back to you. I'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah, really. I did a podcast with somebody in the about finances. Definitely a different take. Her name is Shang Saavedra, and she's based in San Diego now. I think she was in, or maybe she was in New York. She and her husband, by the way, you may not want to talk about this, but what about your personal life?
Yeah. What about it?
Do you have time for a relationship? Do you make time for a relationship?
I'm married. Yeah.
No shit.
Yeah. I make time for everything.
When did you get married?
A year and some few months ago.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
You make enough time for your wife.
I hope so.
Good. That is the right answer.
I got to try.
Yeah. That's the right answer. That's great. That's fabulous.
I find a way to squeeze in whatever I need to do. I'll find a way to make it work. So something gets squeezed, but it's in there.
Well, that's a really important one. A really important one. That'll feed your soul in ways that, you know.
Yeah. I just think there's a lot of time throughout the day that just people waste, that's procrastinate. Like if I really need to, like it might take me, let's just say 8 hours to make a video. But if I really needed to and I was like, dialed in, focused, no distractions, I could probably get that done in 6, which means I have 2 hours extra to spend on something else. So if you really need to do it, you could condense down, you know, just not get distracted.
And what does your wife think about this way of approaching life? Does she do the same thing?
Yeah. I mean, she would tell me all the time, it's just being kind of stupid or I shouldn't do that. And I'll just do it. So she would probably be more balanced than me, but she'd also probably indulge in like more stuff that I wouldn't, let's just say, of like, you know, probably she loves Legos. So she'd be going like crazy on like big Lego collections. Yeah, Legos. Yeah.
Wait, does she use them or does she just collect them?
Building them.
She does.
Yeah. She's opened my mind to this whole new community of like Legos are like a serious, they're coming back. They're really coming back now. Like Legos now aimed towards adults, like young adults. Yeah. And they're like 20s and 30s. It's because these sets are both expensive and they're very intricate. And so they're releasing like a lot of Lego sets mainly for adults.
And are they still similar sized? Or I know they have, you know, larger ones elsewhere, but are they still
thousands? I mean, I'm talking thousands of pieces. I mean, a Lego's a Lego, but it's turned into like this little thing to now it's like 3 feet tall, 4 feet wide. I mean, they're big things. So I'm learning a lot about Legos and they do like different, like they had a whole Keith Haring Lego set to honor Keith Haring. Like again, that's not something a child today would be like, I want the Keith Haring, but adults know that and they would get this and they're really cool looking sets and they have like art, like they have a Lego Mona Lisa. Like a Lego Monet, like all these just sets that, it's an adult hobby now.
So what does your house look like? Is it filled with Legos everywhere?
Legos and just random collectibles that I've picked up along the way.
Wait, so were you, is my memory like way off? Were you collecting cars or were you, you were fascinated by
cars? Yeah. Yeah. Cars. Yeah.
What are you driving?
Daily driving a Model 3, that's the commuter. But beyond that, a Ford GT 2005 as the like investment, the original Tesla Roadster that I also got as an investment and that's not doing so well. And then a Lotus Evora GTC that it was a good deal. And I like the good deal.
And do you drive it or you're in its garage someplace?
There's nowhere to drive to. It's like I work from home. If I go somewhere, it's usually a quick errand. And it's easier just to pop in the Model 3.
Right.
If I pull out a car from the garage, I have to move a car out of the way because the cars are parked in front of the garage. So I got to move a car out of the garage. And I got to pull the car out and then pull it back and move the car back. And it's a shuffle. So.
I'm asking you all these personal questions. Yeah, you don't have. So are kids in the picture?
One day. Yeah. One day. I just feel like right now things are so nice and there's no obligation. You could, for the most part, up and leave wherever we want, whenever we want. Having that freedom is amazing, and I definitely want to travel more. So I think next year, going on, really seeing more of the world. Like, we've been to Japan a few times. I love it there. But really seeing more of the world. I know this is going to be probably the last opportunities you would have without kids to do that.
What are you curious about?
What am I curious about? I'm always thinking of stuff. So,
is that a stoplight calculating?
Well, I always like to think, like, what's the next big thing? I like to figure out, like, where's a trend going? And one of the trends now that I'm seeing is seems to be energy usage is really increasing a lot, like electricity costs because of data centers and AI. And then I'm thinking, okay, well, where's that energy going to come from? And I start researching. I say, wait a second, nuclear is probably going to be the most, it's going to be the safest, and it's going to be the most, what do you call it? Like the best for the planet, but it's very expensive, takes a long time. So that's not going to be right now. Yeah. And then, I think hydrogen is great, but it's very dangerous, and it's very unstable. So like, that's not going to. And then you get into like turbines and things like this. And the answer is yes, but they can only do so much. They have to have downtime. They're bad. The pollutants are bad. So it's just kind of going through and thinking, okay, well, what's going to be the solution to this? Because it's not just burning fossil fuels forever. Like, what is it going to be? Is it? And then trying to think, okay, which company is going to be at the forefront of that? And so I always like to think, you know, okay, where's something going? And how could I try to be like a few steps ahead and just think beyond today?
You got any clues?
It seems like, and full disclosure here, but I invested a small amount, not to feel like I'm missing out, but I put like 15 grand to a company called Bloom Energy.
Oh, yeah.
They seem to be, from everything I've seen, the best company that's at least well positioned to capture a lot of the data or a lot of the energy for data companies. So I don't know if I'll make a larger investment, but since I put that in, they're up 30% already in 2 weeks.
Wait, Bloom Energy, but where's the source of their energy? Where's the source of the energy?
They do. It's like a unique blend. Hold on. So I'd rather read. Natural gas, biogas, and they convert it in such a way without combustion.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But their benefit is that they're able to get up and running faster without the downtime.
Yeah, well, that's it. That's the code everybody wants to crack, right?
Yeah.
You bet.
So, we'll see. But I also think just AI in general.
I was going to say AI is obviously, you know, but there's such a crowded, crazy space with huge players.
It is, but I mean, it's just like I'm using chat. I don't really use Google anymore. I'm just use ChatGPT.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting. Yeah. Well, Graham Stephan,
thank you
once again. Thank you, and congratulations. I didn't know you were married, and I'm happy to hear that. And what do you folks think about your newfound life?
Well, they love it. They've always been very supportive. They just want the best for me.
That's great.
And they want me to be happy, and so I'm stoked.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.